Hey guys, Josh Hankin here. It is a cold, rainy day here in Vegas. And I'm sure if you're in the Northeast or Midwest, you think I'm crazy saying it's cold, but it's all relative, right? I wanted to take an opportunity to discuss the idea of planks today. I know that might be something that seems so common sense to people nowadays that there is nothing left to say, but I wanted to go against some of the myths, clarify some concepts, and give you guys some better ideas of how to actually get results with them. So first off, real quick, we are doing these videos a little bit more, so I think it's just easier for some people to take in the information. Also, we're going to be plugging in some video examples. So if you guys don't have an opportunity, if you're just listening to the audio, definitely take an opportunity to maybe scroll through later on and go through some of the visuals. I think they will help you. So let's start the foundation. So there's a consistent group of people that will downplay the impact of planks. So planks were never meant to be this all-encompassing problem-solving exercise that did everything possible for the core. What it really was about was teaching some foundational concepts of good core stability. So for example, a negative people will say to doing planks is you can't move, right? And you know, in life and sport, we move, we're dynamic. Well, obviously, you know, that is a goal of a plank is to teach you how to resist force. But again, you have to appreciate if we don't have foundation set that allow us to navigate more complex environments, then trying to throw yourself into a more complex environment doesn't help. So an analogy I often like to use with people is just taking something like math and saying like, hey, if people were to argue that, you know, calculus is really the math that we use to figure things out, there's really no point in doing addition and subtraction. I think a lot of people would say, but addition and subtraction starts to set a foundation for progressively higher levels of math. Same thing with a plank. The plank doesn't solve everything in of itself. It sets a foundation. And what is that foundation that we're trying to teach? So what Dr. Stuart McGill talks about is this idea of teaching all the 35 muscles of the core to work synergistically to create that stability through some foundational tension. So basically it's getting everything to work at one time to create this stiffness around our trunk that allows us to learn how to prevent unwanted motion. It's learning how to brace, right? And that's why Dr. McGill references doing just like 10 seconds worth of work, because that tension we create is very high, and to do it properly, it's very fatiguing. So even a lot of people can't even do it for 10 seconds when you do it correctly at first. So you may have to work out like just 5 seconds at a time, like 5 seconds on, 5 seconds off, and so forth. But the point is that learning how to brace properly is going to set the foundation for us to do everything else with our core training, just like we would in that math example, right? As we get to higher levels, if we don't have that foundation in place, if we don't know how to brace, even at the most basic level, how are we going to do those higher level actions, right? And we're not meant to walk around like zombies, you know, because we can't move our trunk. That's not what Dr. McGill talks about at all. But it reminds me a lot about, you know, some martial arts I'm learning about, and the idea that, you know, there's a balance of tension and relaxation, but first you have to learn how to create tension. Same kind of concept here. If you don't know how to create that foundation, and the way to think about tension is stability, is really what we're talking about, then it's hard to go to higher level actions. We don't want you walking around with a rigidity that a plank shows you. Dr. McGill doesn't want that either. He talks about that if you actually get into his work. So the plank is really about teaching that foundational bracing, stiffness, and stability. So what is that? If I'm talking to a client, how do I get them to understand this, right? Well, for one, it's going to go into how we cue the exercise, and we'll go into that in a moment. But let's also just talk about verbalization and communication, getting them a mindset. So the example I always give that seems to work really well with people is imagine you're on the beach, someone attractive walks by and wants to pat you on the stomach. Almost all of us naturally tighten up, right? We want to show our best selves. That's an easy concept for people to start understanding what we want them to do and feel. Now, when we talk actually about cueing a plank, so a couple of things. So for one is, I don't like the dear God plank, so I'm clasping my hands together, things like that, because it tends to have people turn their elbows out. And when we do that, we lose that lat integration, and the lats are a huge core stabilizer. So I often tell people you can have your hands neutral so that your pinky side would be facing down the ground, or palms up where you could push down in the palms of your hands. The reason I don't like palms down generally is because people might roll their shoulders and round their shoulders in the process. And in general, we want our shoulders over our elbows, our elbows into our side, and we want to be able to push through the balls of our feet. So what we're going to do is we're not going to think about lifting our hips up as much as we are pushing our body into the ground. So to avoid that weird thing where you tell people lift your hips up and they're too high, you go a little bit lower, you go, now they're too low. So a little bit up, go down, you go through that whole process with people. And then you try to manually get people there. That's a very inefficient, ineffective way of people to learn this. Is simply I start people from the ground. So we're going to start you with your forearms on the ground, the balls of the feet on the ground, and your knees on the ground. And what I'm going to do is tell you to press through your forearms, your balls of your feet. And that is going to get what elevates your hips up. And you're going to find your legs go to lockout. And everyone's worried about like, hey, your legs are locking out, which is funny because nowadays in this current era, like everyone's put their knees over their toes, but now we can't lock out joints. So locking out, there's a difference between hyperextension and locking out. So hyperextension would be more like I lack the control and my body just goes there because of my structure. I don't have really control over there. Locking out is a natural mechanism that happens when I create force in a certain direction because that's where I'm going to be my strongest. That's where I'm going to be, have my biggest base of stability. So when you do that, you will also find that the glutes tighten up. So we should actually see a little posterior pelvic tilt of the pelvis. Now, it may be hard to know or ask someone, do they feel that versus just seeing if the glutes tighten up. I don't want to say squeeze the glutes because I can have my hips elevated and still squeeze my glutes, but I should be able to push the balls of my feet, create that lockout. If I'm in the right alignment, that locking out will then lead up to my glutes tightening up and my pelvis going in that posterior rotation. Now I'm in that fully locked and tight position. A great way of thinking about it is it's the top of your deadlift. Right? That's what you should be like at the top of your deadlift. You're pressing down, you're pulling the handles apart really hard, you're creating all that tension for stability. You know, you're pushing the earth away from you, you're getting really tall. You know, you don't go squeeze your glutes. It should be pushing the earth away from you. So that's why oftentimes in our DVRT courses, we parallel planks and deadlifts because there's a lot of carryover from one to another. So that's your foundation. Now let's talk about the reality here. Now, once you do a plank correctly, you're going to find a lot of times people can't start there. It's just too much for them, especially if you're talking about deconditioned people, people that are very overweight, elderly people, people that might be injured. They can't maybe support their body weight in that manner. So that's why oftentimes we start in a quadruped position and we teach basically the same thing. Now, instead of your arms being on the ground, we'll use our hands. And so again, as we often talk about, if your hands are ever on the ground, you're going to treat them like your feet. And so you're going to actively grab for the ground. And so what you want to do is turn your hands slightly out. If your hands are neutral or go in, you'll tend to see people use their upper traps and shoulders versus their lats and core. And you want to be careful to set up your shoulders over your hands in the process. So when you do that and you create that tension, you should notice that by grabbing the ground, you create a little arch in your hand, which is just like having an arch in your foot. And we all know if you don't have an arch in your foot, you're going to have more problems up your chain, specifically like your knees, your low backs. Well, now if you don't create arch in your hand when it's on the ground, you can have problems in the wrist, the elbow, the shoulder, the neck, and so forth. So that's why it's so important. And what we can do is we can practice this, creating that tension with our hands and the balls of our feet. And by having the knees still on the ground, obviously we're deloading the body a little bit. It's a lot more accessible to people. Sure, you can put mats under people's knees. I don't care. As long as they can still get their feet comfortably in contact with the body, the ground, I'm sorry. If you want to put people on massage tables, whatever it is, put them in an environment that they feel confident and competent in. Now, that's also why we don't go immediately right to planks from there. We go to a lot of our bird dog work. And I think a lot of people misunderstand what we're using our bird dog drags and our drags in general for. So there's two things that are or maybe even three things that are happening with our drags. For one, we're trying, it's actually easier to do the drags than it is to do a body weight, either a bird dog, for example, because when you do a body weight bird dog, what you're doing is you're using the movement of the arm and the leg to create a lever arm to challenge the stability of the core, right? You want, as the arm and leg move out, not have the trunk move in any form, right? But here's the problem. You have no feedback in that environment. So it's all related to reactive or reflexive stability. The type of stability we actually want to eventually get to that relates more to like everyday activities, right? Where we have that, you know, quick balance of relaxation and tension of our trunk that allows us to walk, move, and do things freely in life. But initially, people need some feedback. you know, trying again, giving you guys going back to the plank, if you're doing a bird dog with people and they're turning out their foot and they can't control their pelvis and you're, you know, running around trying to put your hands on them, that's artificial feedback. That's not teaching them how to control their own body. So what we are often doing is we're using the ultimate sandbag and the friction and tension that we create to build connection and feedback to teach people how to control their body. So in actuality, the bird dog drag comes way before we do, let's say, a body weight bird dog, because again, that reactive or reflexive stability demands are much higher. So what people miss out often is they think it's just a transition of weight from side to side. As I've often talked about, that's not what we're doing. If you do that, fine, but that's not a lateral drag in our DVRT system. The point is to take the advantage of the unique fact that ultimate sandbags have dimension to it, and very deliberate dimension, right? We've spent a lot of years trying to figure out what size works best, you know, and so forth. Whereas if you use a dumbbell or a kettlebell, the contact with the ground is very small. So what ends up happening is you're not getting a lot of that friction, relying much more on the load of the equipment, which is not what we're after here. We want that friction in combination with the load to have synergy in the feedback and the strength that we're building in the trunk. We also then look at, you know, the fact that because the ultimate sandbag is not one piece, for example, it's not, you know, one piece of metal, there's obviously stitching involved and so forth, we have pliability to it. So what we can do is we can create pretension by making sure that we're using a palm up grip. So again, we're using either a core or power ultimate sandbags. If you want, need to make it harder, trust me, there's ways to make it harder without going to the larger ultimate sandbags. We want to use that outside handle because the outside handle is lower to the ground. So it keeps us having our lats and core engaged the entire time. Versus if we try to grab a neutral grip handle on our bigger ultimate sandbags, it's going to make us use our shoulder more in our upper trap, and we don't obviously want that. So by what we want to do is grab, and before we even start moving, I want to create some pretension by taking any slack out of the ultimate sandbag. That little pretension starts to help me load my lat, get my core more engaged. Plus, having my hand closer to my center of mass is much easier than having my arm away from my body. So again, that's why this is a starting point for people. It's not the progression from the body weight bird dog or the, you know, things like that. And the position of the ultimate sandbag is so important. I often joke that you want logo side up because we want good branding. But in all seriousness, the reason we have logo side face up, it's just an easy visual cue for your clients to understand what position the ultimate sandbag should be so that's in the proper position. Because if it's on its side and you're turning your hand in a weird angle, it's going to take away from the movement. So we always want palm up, but we're going to create tightness with a grip because grip is related to the lats and shoulder and so forth. So we also want to make sure that the ultimate sandbag is positioned at the right place. So again, if the bag is closer to my wrist, it's going to be my shoulders, which is what I don't want. So we definitely tell people we cue around the belly button area. It might be just slightly higher than the belly button, but I'd rather be a little bit lower than too high, because when I go low, it's much easier for me to keep that lat engagement, which keeps my core more engaged, versus if I go higher up, now I get my shoulder and I take away from that core. So you're starting to see that everything is a very deliberate action. So that's what's happening from the top side up. And what a lot of people get fixated upon is the movement of the ultimate sandbag, which I understand, it's the weight, right? It's the task. But what they forget is that the more important hand almost is the one that remains on the ground. So a lot of times when people go to do any type of drag in our system, they lose tension in that stance arm. So I need to actually reinforce what's happening in that stance arm, the one that's remaining on the ground even more so. So what can I do as a coach? I can, you know, verbally give them cues like, hey, make sure to grab the ground. Or I can come around and try to lift their fingers off the ground and tell them, don't let me lift your fingers. Don't let me lift my fingers. And reflexively, they'll grab onto the ground to maintain that stability. So again, it takes a little time because there's two things going on, right? I'm dragging, but I'm also pushing the entire time. That's why this is a great strong pushing drill for people. So if you want to build a push-up strength, any type of upper body strength, this is a huge foundation. You're going to see all that scapular stability. So if you want a strong serratus interior, you want fixed scapular stability, these cues is how we do it. We don't do it by isolating the serratus interior or trying to isolate the scapula. We do it by integration in a smart and specific way. So then the lower body, we have to think about the same thing. So if we just lift up the leg, number one, that's our improper cue because people are task-oriented. They'll just want to lift up their leg. And that's where they dump into their pelvis, right? Because they think the goal is to lift their leg up as high as possible. Rather, we want to kick in the wall behind us. But even then, that's a long lever arm on my pelvis, right? So a lot of people can't start there. So that's why you'll often see us introduce gliders at first, because it allows us to keep the range of motion lower. So the intensity, the loading upon the trunk is lower. So we'll use a slider just to learn, because we want to still be pushing down that foot. We want both feet to be active as we're pushing down and pulling back in. We want to actively pull that leg back in. We just don't want to casually do it. It should be slow and controlled in both, but it should be very deliberate at the same time. So oftentimes what we'll do is we'll have people just have the upper body in contact with the ground first. So both hands on the ground, just work on the lower body movement, right? People find that incredibly exhausting if you're maintaining proper tension in the upper body and you're using deliberate action in the lower body. So, you know, like 5 reps, you know, can smoke people, right? Give them a break, get them out of it, do something else, come back to it. Then we'll work on just the upper body while keeping the lower body. So when the lower body is not moving, the balls of the feet are driving in, right? So we can do that. So we're segmenting it so that people don't get overwhelmed with too many moving parts at first. And then eventually we can start to combine them. But that's what that issue is, that people don't understand what we're trying to do and they jump too many progressions and they wonder why things don't work or their clients don't perform these exercises well. So you see all the layers that we can potentially build just with that bird dog drag, which is why it's so foundational to our system, before we get to the plank drag. Because again, like my math example, going all the way back, if we don't have that foundation in place, when you do plank drags, that's where you see people do all this bad technique. They toss a bag back and forth. They lift the weight up. They use the wrong handle position. They use the wrong handles. The weight's too high. They get their shoulders. Their hips are elevated. And that reminds me, like, you can have your back flat, but your hips flexed. So again, there's a difference between being, you know, in a complete straight line like so versus being here. So you see the difference, and that's what a lot of people do in their plank drags. They have a flat back, but their hips are actually flexed. And when your hips are flexed, you're not getting the extension of the hips, so you're not getting that glutes and hamstrings involved, which is what we want to see. And that's what gives us, remember, that little posterior movement of the pelvis, which gives us that stability that we're looking for in the exercise. So that's why when you go to a plank drag, it's so intense. A plank drag is definitely now a progression of a plank, because we have to resist more moving parts, right? We have to resist rotation. We have to resist lateral shifting. And obviously we have less points of contact with the ground as we're dragging the weight across our body. So what we generally tell people is you want to aim for about 4 to 6 seconds to go from one side to the other side of the body. And a good cue, whether you're doing the bird dogs or our plank drags, is you want to start the bag about, the bag is split halfway on my arm or my hip. If the bag is like way out and away from you, either in the starting position or as you drag across, you're going to end up going to that rotation. You're going to lose that plank. So I'd rather you have a smaller distance of the drag than try to drag the weight really far and then get out of position and alignment. Even if you do a relatively small distance of dragging, it should allow you to slow down and keep contact with the ground much better, which is often shown by keeping that dragging arm straight and locked. The minute that elbow bends is where you get into trouble, you get into the shoulder, you take away from the lats and the core. So you start to see that if we want to get the benefits of these drills and start to build that foundation to higher level movements, we have to understand exactly what we're trying to achieve and how we're going to achieve it. All this work sets up us being able to take those concepts to more dynamic actions like max lunges, to power cleans and so forth, where we're not going to hold all that tension, but we know how to create the brace and we know how to do it at the right time. If I don't know how to create that brace and I haven't built it up progressively to higher level movements, well, how am I going to teach people to create stability when we're in more sophisticated environments where they have to be more reactive and more reflexive to both the weight that is moving and my body motion at the same time? So I hope these concepts help clear up some of the confusion around, you know, what are planks for, when do I use them, and how do I progress some of your drags, and how do I teach them properly to my clients? You'd be surprised. I say this all the time in our courses. If I were to take DVRT and do a group training class, it might look crazy to you because people would be doing very different things, but they're all doing actually the exact same exercise, just at a different level. They don't need to know one's more advanced than the other, but I need to quickly identify what's most appropriate to that individual. If I don't have a system, if I don't understand what I'm trying to accomplish, then I struggle and I give some people too advanced of an exercise, I give people too easy of an exercise, and no one has a good experience. So the cool thing with our DVRT system, whether you're doing one-on-one or you're doing groups, you can always customize to that individual by very simple principles of how we look at progression of movement. If you don't know how to progress movement though, then you're stuck with just exercise, and that's what limits a lot of people. So if you guys have questions about what we talked about, definitely send some information to info@ultimatesandbagtraining.com. Jessica is actually going to be teaching a restoration course that covers a lot of these concepts in Northern California in February. So if you want more information on that, you can check the link below. Obviously, if you're listening to this, then check out our blog. We also have a lot of this material in our DVRT level one online certification, as well as our restoration and our lift program. So if you want to see lift is great and how we integrate other tools, restoration and the level one definitely show you good foundations and taking these DVRT principles, making them very applicable to people so they can be successful. So they want to do more training with you. All right, guys, till next time, this is Josh Hankins signing off.